Welcome to Packet Pushers, a show about data networking, and today we are going to do a long-awaited OSPF design part two, and let me set up the backstory for this. Back in, part one, we had a show with Derek Winkworth and Darren O'Connor, if I remember right, and we talked about how you can run a really big OSPF network in one area, which kind of blows away most of the design guides and things that are published in networking textbooks and so on, because they always guide you into doing multiple areas. And in that show, we said, hey, service providers scale OSPF huge with a single backbone area, no other areas except for maybe a very rare circumstance, and it's fine. 1,000 routers in an area, tons of churn, network links going up and down and so on, and that's all not a problem for them. And so we were kind of making the case, yeah, you don't really need to do multiple areas all the time. Well, in this show, which is OSPF Design Part 2, we're going to flip that on its head and say, well, no, there really are some cases where you do want multiple areas and why. And we have a couple of guests joining us who've been on the show before, Scott Morris and Russ White. And before we introduce those guys, hi, Greg.
Hi, Mr. Banks.
How are you?
I've just finished recording the Network Break 24 with Mr. Conry Murray.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like postprandial following that show because there was much ranting there. And it's sort of like I feel like I should be having a cigarette and lying back, really.
So typically you don't rant a lot on Network Break, you're trying to tell me.
So which of you went to sleep first?
Well, we've just done the Network Break, which is a show where I sit down with Drew Conry Murray and we go over the news. And we really just sort of quickly chat. We try and keep it as short and sharp as possible at 30 minutes. But turns out you can get a fair bit of ranting into 30 minutes. And this week, at least, there was lots of things to talk about. So if you are interested in a fast and furious review of what's in the news and some quick discussion and thoughts about it, head over to the Network Break channel and tune right in, would you please?
Well, very good. And I guess we should jump from that and then start talking about OSPF-y sorts of things. And so why don't we introduce our guests? And first up, been on the show many times, Russ White, would you say hi and tell people a bit about yourself?
Hi.
Oh. Nice.
Now he's going to say a bit about myself.
A bit about myself. No.
Russ was recently in a 12-step program for networking.
So, oh my goodness.
If it was a Cisco program, it'd have 36 steps.
Well, it could have been an hex.
Okay, so I'm a principal engineer for Ericsson where I work on IPOS, which is the Ericsson operating system. And I do all sorts of other odds and ends. And this morning, I came to the conclusion that cloud has definitely reached its hype cycle peak, and it is going down.
Oh, so have we not yet reached the SDN hype cycle peak?
Well, I don't know about SDNs yet, but because D-Link is now making a cloud IP camera.
Well, there you go.
You're only coming to that realization now.
The world is going to hell.
And here I thought, I don't know if you noticed the news that Cisco made doing big data now. It's released an analytics system where it scoops up all the data from your network and sucks it into their cloud and provides you with analysis. Cisco's now a cloud company. It's got to be worth at least 20% on their share price.
And new sales leads for the Cisco account teams.
My firewall generate that Cisco is already in big data.
The things that Russ didn't say about himself is he's also an author of works with the IETF, and he's the author of a number of books that cover routing protocols and so on, while we're sitting here going back and forth and smarting off about hype cycles and so on, and including, routing protocol design? No, optimal routing design. I'm looking over my shelf.
The Art of Network Architecture is the latest, Ethan.
That's the latest, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm working on two more.
Yeah. Yeah, so Russ knows a thing or two about routing protocols. And another guy who knows a lot about routing protocols is Mr. Scott Morris. If you would introduce yourself.
Sure. Like you said, my name is Scott Morris. Short answer is I've been around for god-awful long time. Currently, I am working at CBT Nuggets, so kind of getting my training back on for everybody. But otherwise, still travel the world and do different network designs and consulting and work with lots of clients and have all sorts of fun and get to harass people like Russ in multiple places and even multiple countries.
Very good. Well, Russ and Scott, thanks a lot for joining us. And why don't we jump into this discussion about OSPF, and let's make the case for areas in this show. I know we were talking offline, Scott, and you had mentioned you had seen some networks where customers were running multiple areas that probably didn't need to, and then on the other hand, people running one big area when they should have been running multiple areas. When do you look at a network and go, we need to break this thing up into areas? And maybe first of all, why don't you define what an area is?
Well, so, okay, I mean, an area you can look at for a number of different reasons as far as its existence, but short answer is it's a method of organization. Whether we're talking about organizing your SPF domain, so your calculation of areas, or you're looking at organizing where the routes are from a summarizing point of view, but it's a method of organizing is kind of the short way of looking at that. And so I kind of use that as, you know, really my argument or reasoning for when you start looking at networks and deciding should or shouldn't, or, you know, really don't care kind of point of view. It's like walking into your room and seeing whether or not it needs to be organized better than what it currently is. Now, if you come over to my house, and granted, I've got two little girls still who have not managed to get this concept of cleaning up their rooms, I am in high need of areas in my house.
Scott, you have the same problem I do. They like meshy networks.
Oh, yes, yes. I find messy, that I have area overflow no matter what I sell.
Very much. Yeah, and I got some bad news. I have an older girl, and although her area is contained to a cubic footage that I can shut the door on, it is pretty horrible when you look in there. And you go, wow, what happened?
Well, you know, but see, that's why they invented not-so-stubby areas.
Well, we really should be trainers. We shouldn't. You know, in terms of bringing metaphorical images to the understanding of the OSPF routing protocol.
I want to add something, though, Scott. Beyond organization, I think that areas are important in breaking up failure domains. Actually, you know, what a lot of people don't realize about OSPF is, because it's a link state protocol, you actually have two kinds of aggregation going on. And, you know, when you talk about aggregating routing, you're actually out talking about aggregating topology information versus aggregating reachability information. It's completely distinct ideas between those two.
So let's actually set up a little bit more context for listeners about areas. You know, if for those of you that aren't don't really work on a big OSPF network, or you've maybe only used it a little bit, OSPF has this concept of areas, and there's one area that most OSPF networks are going to start with, and maybe it's the only area they have. That's area zero, the backbone area. Okay. Now you can build another area, an area one or an area two, or give it some other numerical designation or an IP address to designate it. And then you put a bunch of other routers in that area. And then between those areas, between area zero and some other area, you've got an area border router that routes traffic between those two areas. So you've got logically grouped routers and routes within each area. And then you can treat each area in a different way. And there's one other big rule here, which is every area has got to connect back to area zero. This is a hub and spoke kind of a setup. You can't have area zero connected to area one and then area one connecting over to area two. It doesn't work that way. Everything's got to connect back to area zero. Jeff Doyle's got a great explanation for this on Network World as to why that is.
Basically, it's because when you do ABRs, you're converting from a link state protocol to a distance vector protocol, and OSPF is not a very good distance vector protocol. It doesn't know how to do loop freeness very well between build a loop in the areas.
It's an issue of loop prevention, right? And so you end up with this, you know, OSPF design where you've got area zero in the middle and a bunch of other areas kind of hanging off of it, hub and spoke style. Any area that wants to get to any other area has to traverse area zero to make that happen. Okay, so that's, you know, fundamentals here of what these areas are. You've got an area border router that sits in between a couple of different areas, or between area zero and, you know, whatever the other area is. Now let's get into...
And Ethan, you don't have to have different area numbers for your different areas. They just have to be disconnected.
Yeah, that is true, and I've actually done that. You know, I've got a little management area that I'll use, area 254, that will have one VRF in it for one router that I use it for nothing more than management, and I can have as many different little area 254s as I want out there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I once worked on a production network where all the areas were area 51. It was quite...
That's good. Yeah, I mean, it does make it easier if you accidentally connect them together. At least you won't have failures.
We'll certainly know about it.
Yeah, right. Actually, yeah. Wow, my routing table got bigger.
Now, Scott, you had mentioned not-so-stubby areas earlier. Why don't we take a step further back from that and point out there's a lot of different areas. Areas are useful to be a container of routers and routes and as a failure domain, but then there's different types of areas which serve different purposes. Did you want to walk us through those?
Sure. I mean, you know, quite simply from the RFC standpoint, and also keep in mind that, you know, RFCs have been around a while. I mean, what, 2328 was a long, long time ago. And, you know, from that standpoint, you have to kind of think about that a lot of the rules that we're looking at, and again, kind of going back to your discussion, you said from the last podcast of, you know, why you could do it with a single area, is that the networking world and the equipment that we have today is different than what there was 10, 15, 20 years ago. So all the rules were made based on the way that not only networks were designed and working, but also the equipment that they had and problems that they had at that point in time.
Yeah, the control plane processing power, being able to deal with changes in the topology and keeping calculations timely and so on.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, in looking at what they try to do to maintain stability in the network, nowadays we look at it and say, yeah, it's really not as important. But, you know, even going down that, you have your basic stub area, which the catch to it is that you're not going to have your external routes. So any of your type 5s, you're not going to have, not going to exist.
Stub area, meaning the routes that are coming from area 0 and being advertised into this stub area are limited. We were filtering off certain kinds of routes that we're just not going to announce into that other area.
Correct. You're only going to have your internal routes, so things that you're getting intra-area or inter-area, mm-hmm. but not externals. When you get to a totally stubby area, on the other hand, you also filter out the other inter-area routes, kind of leave everything to a default. You know, so if you just want to completely have a smaller routing table in that area and you only have one way or, you know, one or two ways to go out through your ABR anyway, then just keep it simple with a 0-0.
The stub areas are useful for keeping your routing information and keeping your routing tables inside that area pretty tidy, because there's a lot of stuff you don't have. I mean, you mentioned external routes, which would be routes coming from outside of the native OSPF routing system, correct. From some other protocol being redistributed into OSPF, perhaps, and then announced. But they're, hey, we learned these from outside of OSPF. They weren't originated within OSPF. And then the internal routes there as well. Yeah, stub areas, I think of them as back in the day as, well, you know, when router memory was really limited and I didn't want the router to have to know about anything he didn't really need to know about, then I'd be very careful to use stub areas and reduce the number of routes there. But as you were saying, modern routers, is that really a big issue?
Well, I mean, not as much, but also keep in mind that another one of those things that we got into with it, and I'm kind of historically moving forward to why we introduced the not-so-stubby area to begin with, was the old world of dial-up modems. And when we did dial-up modems, we had a whole lot of /32 routes that would come and go and come and go and come and go. And so when doing that, we not only wanted to isolate the advertisement of them, but also isolate the number of routers that were having to freak out and recalculate every time something would go up or down or up or down.
So you'd have a router, I mean, just to set context for this, since no one does dial, I mean, very few people are going to be doing dial-up modems anymore. You've got a dial-in router with a PRI of some sort, the modem comes in, connects with PPP, whatever it might be, gets assigned an IP address, which is then announced as a /32 host route into the OSPF system. That's the scenario?
Because each modem interface was an interface.
Yes,
so every
yes.
modem connected to an interface. So when the interface came up, it injected a /32 root. It
right.
wasn't an op.
Right.
In those days, there wasn't
any configuration for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing was, you know, we had thousands of modems in pools a lot of times. So you're talking about a lot of routes changing on the larger providers. And, you know, think about this today. It's like, you know, if you had, and I don't care what size network you have, but if you're looking at your network, at all your links to your network, and every single link would flap up and down in some random intermittent value, and so your routing table keep changing, you'd be having a really bad day.
Well, back in the old days, there was a couple of things there. One is every time a modem answered a call, which was typically, and calls were timed per hour back then. So it was in people's interest to drop a call and then reinitiate it again. So the interface would come up, inject a /32 root into the OSPF area. Somebody could come in on any modem in a bank, so it could actually be between racks. So there used to be days where we had racks with 20, what was back then an AS5300. An AS5300 would have 8 E1 interfaces sort of thing. Each E1 was 20 or 30 modem banks, if you like. And so you could have like, you know, 250 interfaces per rack going up and down every hour. And you could have that distributed across multiple racks, across multiple, you know, things. Now, the trick here was that the AS5800 had a CPU that was about as powerful as a Spectrum ZX80. We didn't use Intel Celerons in those days. Cisco cut corners to use the cheapest possible CPU that was possible, and they just didn't have the processing power to be continually handling the SPF algorithm to keep recalculating it. So every time the root flapped, the SPF would have to recalculate to make sure the routes were updated at that time. Yeah. It changed later. There was various efficiency introduced later, but that's fundamentally the limitation.
So, yeah, I would say that it's more than just processing power that's made such a huge difference in area size. You know, the Cisco website used to say you can put 40 routers in an area, and people actually stuck to that rule for years. Actually, when it showed up in TAC and escalation team, we had to do some serious work to get that little piece of information scrubbed off. But, you know, when you start looking at constrained SPF and you start looking at traffic engineering and MPLS, what has happened is that the guys who write the SPF code, both for ISIS and for OSPF, have had to introduce a ton of efficiencies, such as partial SPFs and things of that nature, where you run shortcuts in your algorithm so that you can run thousands of SPF calculations on a single processor. So, you know, it's not just more memory and more power. It's also more efficient algorithms over the years as people have started using SPF for a lot more things. And so, you know, there's been a lot of gains here. You know, all that said, though, there's still a reason to use areas in my mind, which is that I go back to my dual concepts of aggregation of reachability information, which, by the way, has a trade-off and reduction or splitting failure domains. If I had a data center that was running a fairly large spine and leaf topology running OSPF, I wouldn't want that in the same area as a hub-and-spoke network reaching out to my retail stores or something like that. It just as a matter of separating complexity from complexity, you know, whether you call it organization or failure domain separation, it's a good idea just to keep those things separate in your network.
So give an example of a failure domain here, or give an example of a failure here. If we're talking about a failure domain as a group of routers that are all impacted by some event that happens within that domain, do you have a scenario you could describe that would help help listeners visualize an OSPF failure that they'd want to keep a limited domain around?
Right. I mean, a perfect example to me is having like a full mesh or having a highly meshed core and then have a hub-and-spoke network with like 500 to 1,000 or 1,500 retail stores or branch locations hanging off of it. You don't want a couple of randomly flapping links in those retail stores to actually bring down your network core simply because you've overwhelmed the amount of traffic that goes on in that network. Another example, you know, when you talk about stubbies and totally stubbies is redistribution at your edge. There have been cases where service providers have accidentally redistributed their BGP table into their OSPF table.
Which is always fun to watch.
Yes.
BGP table like a full internet load BGP table?
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, if the provider in question had been running, you know, like totally stubs or something like that, it might not have taken down their entire network.
Jeepers. Okay.
That's why IBGP works the way it does, is so that you don't have to inject your entire BGP table into OSPF.
Just a fat finger. Somebody just put the wrong redistribution command in the wrong place.
I'm just saying, a lot of people never understand why IBGP works the way it does, why you have to static. And that's why it does, because you don't want to be injecting the full BGP table into the internal routing protocol. My favorite reason for using OSPF stubby areas is security. So when I'm actually connecting to other people's networks, which still happens today, specifically with there's a current trend towards this thing called cloud. Has anybody heard of it?
D-Link is making cloud-based IPs.
Cloud IP-based cameras. So a lot of the cloud providers that I've worked with are now offering dedicated MPLS circuits. So Amazon, the Google, and a lot of the mid-tier cloud providers. Now, most of them are all going to go broke, but until then, this idea of having – you don't want to leak your entire OSPF table into an external party's cloud. A, there's no value to it, and B, you're actually leaking security information about your internal network. If I could tap into – the OSPF table, I could then scope out what your network looks like, and it'd be the first step in an attack phase. So having a stub area and pushing that out into the cloud means that they only see a very small part of the routing table, and their ability to visualize or to, get any useful data from it is seriously restricted.
Yeah. And what we're talking about doing here is the fact that on an area border router, you can do route summarization. And you can't do route summarization in OSPF within an area. In other words, if you've got two routers in the same area and you try to summarize routes between them, there is no such animal. All routers within an OSPF area have to have the same topology database, so it is impossible to filter routes between them. Now, you can filter a route such that it doesn't actually hit the routing table of a router, but the OSPF database still knows about that route. If you want to filter routes between OSPF routers, then you have to have an area border router in two different areas to perform that either route summarization or, route filtering task, if you will.
Yeah. So if you could compromise an OSPF router that you could see every link state in the database, and therefore you could scope out every subnet in the network. And that's,
you can actually run SPF across that database and see exactly how the network is built.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why stub areas is now, I use it almost, the only time I've used it in the last 5 years is for security purposes.
Yeah. So area usage by a reason of trust.
Lack of trust.
Yeah, or lack thereof, yes.
All right, so let me take a minute and tell you about AVIC. AVIC is a SaaS application. It's for small and medium-sized businesses, and it is a network management tool. The whole idea is it makes it easier to build and manage an IT network. Okay, so AVIC's first level of functionality they called SEEC, and the idea is that it focuses on network visibility. So unlike some of the network management tools you get from, really big providers that are selling you massive pieces of network management software, AVIC takes only 5 minutes to install. All you do, download a virtual appliance to your network, and then give it permission to discover your environment. Off you go. And when it's doing that, what's going on is it's going to map your entire network and then capture the profile and configuration of every device, assuming you've authorized it to do that. With that information, it can then track those configs over time and automatically back them up every time there's a change, and then it keeps a log of every version. So let's say you want to go back and revert to an earlier config that you had on that device. You've got a one-button restore that's got you covered to do that. So like any network management platform, AVIC's got a lot of other useful information, helpful usage, performance stats. It pulls your network every 30 seconds, gathering data. And all of that, of course, gives you the insights you need to troubleshoot quickly and plan effectively. Look ahead. What's byte bandwidth utilization? What are the statistics on this device? Do I need to do something different for next year? You've got all the information you need to do those kind of things. And you can do that looking at high-level graphs, give you a general idea of what's going on, or you can drill right down into the details and get just as nitty-gritty as you want. And also, kind of interesting, you can cross-reference the stats to your configuration history, and that way you can correlate, hey, did this change we made somehow impact network performance and what's going through it? Sound interesting? I hope so. If you like the sound of what you hear about AVIC, you can go up to avic.com/pp. That is AUVIK.com/pp, short for packet pushers, and get more info there. And of course, you can try the product out absolutely free. Okay, so we've mentioned area border routers. We've talked about a few use cases for some areas. There's one other term I wanted to throw in here, which is autonomous system boundary router. And this is the deal where we were talking earlier about routes coming in externally, some route that's coming in from an external domain, and then those routes being injected from that external domain into the OSPF area. And that's the job of the ASBR. And if you're looking at your, OSPF routing table, those are the type 5s, or if it's a not-so-stubby area, the type 7s, right? Yeah, it's been a while since I've done this. Yeah. And
But the type 4, Ethan, that's the important one.
That's the tag along.
I have to go back and I'd have to review all these. The only time I review all the different area types there is when I have to do my CCIE research. And then it's like, I got to pound these back in my head again because I never think about
it. The Type 4 LSA must feel so unloved. Nobody ever remembers it.
It's a tag. It's the wingman.
It's the wingman, yeah.
It has to date the ugly girls.
Yep. So the Type 4 LSA is the one that's injected into the Area 0 to say this is the path to the ASBR and the ABRs. If there's multiple ways out of a network for a given route, so it could go through two stub areas, then you need to pick the shortest path. You want to go to the point closest to the area that is nearest to you. The Type 4 is the distance vector protocol part that does that for you.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because what you're actually seeing there is someone making a conscious decision between more control plane state and choosing the optimal route out of the network. You don't actually need the Type 4 to make OSPF work, but it was put in because, like you said, you could have multiple places where that external enters the network. And at your ABR, you're actually taking out the topology information, and at the ASBR, you're actually taking out your metric information so that somebody sitting in Area 0 just sees 5 Type 7 or external routes and has no clue which one is actually close.
Well, so but you got to think about where that comes from, though. It's because of the who injected it. So the originating router ID on a Type 5 isn't changed when it goes between areas because they're domain-wide in scope. So all of a sudden you get to a different area and it says, hey, I was announced by, 10.1.1.1, and everybody's looking around going, where the hell is that? And has no idea how to get there because there's no Type 1 for it in another area. So that's where the Type 4s come in.
So this is a good segue into another design question related to this. So let's say we've decided, hey, we're going to have a multiple area OSPF designs. We've got our Area 0, now we're going to add our Area 1. If we have a ABR that we put in there, by itself it would be a SPOF. We lose connectivity into Area 1 if that one ABR goes down. So we're going to, add a second ABR. What are the design considerations that come in when we start adding multiple ABRs between areas?
Use ISIS, no. Anyway.
Because that magically solves everything.
The biggest issue is where do you put the link between the ABRs? If there's going to be a link between the ABRs, do you put it in Area 0 or do you put it in the outlying area? And the difference is whether you want your suboptimal routing to be, in modern terms, northbound or southbound, because you're going to get suboptimal routing out of it. It's just a matter of where you want it to be.
Well, so explain the scenario. Why is there suboptimal routing in this scenario?
Well, because you are, at the ABR, you are aggregating link state information into simple metrics. So you're basically converting OSPF from a link state protocol into a distance vector protocol at that point. So now some router sitting in Area 0 has nothing but metrics. It doesn't have the actual topology information into that outlying area. So if the link is within the outlying area, then the router in Area 0 can't see that inter-ABR link, so it doesn't know which ABR to exit on to get the best path to the destination.
Because all the cost to him looks the same.
The path to him looks the same. But if you put it in Area 0, you have the opposite problem. The router sitting in the outlying area has now lost that link and doesn't know which is the best path to something out through Area 0 necessarily. So either way, if you set your metrics up right, you end up with suboptimal routing. You just have to choose which direction you want it in.
You could end up with suboptimal route. I mean, it would depend on some things, but you could end up with that scenario.
Yeah, I mean, you should know by now that no matter what your link speed is, everything's a cost of one today.
That's right. That's right. Or one half. Yeah.
Well, there you go. No, I was just thinking, you know, I get more of a hang up, though, on people who don't change the default reference cost and therefore have every single link from 100 meg on up with a cost of one and wonder why they have strange routing going on through the network. You know, why is my 10 gig link not very utilized, but my 100 meg link is just, you know, all completely jacked up? It's like, well, you know, because you made your routers think that way.
We're talking about the fact that OSPF, if you put in a reference cost there that's tied to bandwidth, it will compute the cost of that link based on the speed of that link. Is that unique to Cisco? Because I've been working with Juniper a bit, and it doesn't seem like that's a thing, you know, tying anything or tying OSPF link cost to bandwidth. It seems like I got to manually set cost to whatever I want it to be.
Well, no, because your interfaces have a default speed to them as it is, but Junipers don't treat bandwidth the same way that Cisco does. So there's not quite the bandwidth command, which is really a reference for both routing protocols and QoS stuff that the way Cisco does calculations. That part doesn't exist in the Junos world. But you still have the default speed will absolutely be used when you change your reference bandwidth. And you'll find the same thing that if you're doing aggregate Ethernets in Junos, that it will also calculate based on that as well.
Okay, so another question here regarding dual or multiple ABR design. So we've got routing optimizations to be concerned about. And Russ, I wanted to jump off of that concern. You said, well, the link between the ABRs could be on the area zero side or on the more distant area side. You know, couldn't we have both? And if we had both, does that solve any problems?
Actually, we could, but the OSPF working group hasn't ever adopted the draft that would allow you to do it. There's actually been a draft out there for a long time that would allow you to put a link in two areas simply by building an adjacency in both areas, like ISIS does essentially in level 1 and level 2 routing. But it was never really adopted because the use cases don't seem all that strong, for it.
Now, if I have two ABRs, a lot of times when you have two of anything in the routing protocol world on the wire, one of them becomes a primary role or he takes on some sort of responsibility through an election process. Is there anything like that we're concerned about with ABRs?
Only type 7 to type 5 conversion and generation of type 4, essentially, are the only two things that you get into. And that's basically just a matter of router ID. I don't... Scott, do you remember the exact algorithm? It's been years since I've looked at it.
No, and I was just trying to think about that because I've always gone by telling everybody it's based on router ID, but I mean, you're correct that only one will generate those, which does in and of itself kind of make, change your route optimization because you only have one ABR announcing the things and then that's kind of the path that everybody's going to take to get to them.
Right. If you see a type 4 in area 0 and you see a type 5 because... Even if you're in a totally stubby and you have a type 7 that's been converted to, or not so totally stubby, and you convert your type 7 to a type 5, now we're going to lose our listeners. But anyway.
So no, you got a couple of CCI guys who are paying attention now.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, if you have that type 4.
Because truth will be shared is critical to passing the recertification exam.
Well, right. I was to say, because, the first things out of anybody's mouth is, whoa, Russ is going to be writing the exam now.
No, Russ hasn't been involved in them in years. I work for a competitor now, Scott, so.
I know, so do I.
Yeah, so anyway.
Well, you could put some interesting questions in about Redback and really test their knowledge.
So anyway, that's part, the type 4 would allow you to actually select the ABR that's not generating the type 4 or the type 5, right? Because in theory, once you get the actual ASBR's address, you can compute your SPF to the ABR that has the closest path to that ASBR, regardless of whether or not it's the announcing ABR. So... the type 4 does work out in that way that it allows you to choose the closest path no matter which ASBR or which ABR is advertising the type 4 and or the type 5 if it's a totally stubby and you're converting type 7s.
Hmm.
Wow. Okay.
Well, let's talk about some practical things here. Now, a lot of our listeners aren't running.
That's a good segue. Oh, thank you, Sling, Russ.
Let's boom, drop that. So, a lot of our listeners that are that follow the show don't run huge networks. They're not running massive global enterprise or even national networks. They're running some kind of a mid-level enterprise network, let's say, where they've got a WAN and they've got a small data center maybe, and they've got maybe a couple of campuses that are tied into this thing. Let's say you got, you parachuted in and were asked to come up with an OSPF design for a network like that. It services maybe 2,500 people, 5,000 people. It's spread out over a bunch of locations, as I was describing. Is there some rules of thumb you would go with? How would you analyze that network and give them a recommendation for the area design specifically?
Can I be the first one to say it depends?
Yeah, jump in there and go for it and tell us why it depends.
I love giving that answer anyway.
How many balloons fit in a bag?
Yeah, well, there you go. European or Australian? It's interesting that you say that people may not have a large network for it. And even with not having a large network comes certain constraints that you might want to be paying attention to. So if you have the multiple locations in there, what is the speed of interfaces between those locations? And so therefore, how many routing updates do you really want to be passing across that at any one point in time?
So they could have a WAN that's on, T1 or T3 or something, and they could have a campus that's connected to gig or 10 gig, different considerations at that point.
Yeah, correct. Right. And so if you've got your lower speeds being your chokehold on there, then, you certainly don't want to be, doing SPF calculations all the time for the entire domain everywhere.
So I'll point this out. In networking, we have a very bad habit of thinking of scale as number of routers. Okay, now I've been meaning to do a blog post on this on packet pushers for years and just haven't gotten around to it. It's on my list. So, Ethan, eventually I'll get there. But anyway, but the reality is scaling issues come from complexity of topology and complexity of services offered, not number of routers. So when you start talking about OSPF areas, you start talking about my rule of thumb is always divide complexity from complexity. But what do I mean by complexity? Exactly what Scott's talking about, right? What are my topology elements? What are the services I'm offering? Where do I need to watch for links where I simply cannot take the traffic? So, that's what you've got to think about.
Yeah. Now, I would put the caveat in there, though, that if somebody's running really older routers, then they still may have constraints of scalability based on memory and number of routes.
But, or small.
Older routers, we're talking about, in the Cisco world, maybe 2,500 or 2,600, something like that.
Correct.
Well, if the Cisco website still said you can only put 40 routers in your area when you bought your router...
Now, you and I...
one of those,
Because that's the documentation team. That's a BU problem. That's not a reality.
But those types of things are, like, if you are using older textbooks, that is a good point to raise. That the older textbooks do say that, you need to limit your size of your OSPF areas. But that was literally memory and CPU that drove that limitation, not anything else. Mm-hmm. And so, times are moving on. I mean, the ISR 4400, I was listening to something the other day, and they said they put an altimeter in it. And the reason for that is that people complained about the fans. So now it's cheap enough to put an altimeter in, calculate, and then spin the fans according to how dense the air is. The further up you go, the thinner the air, so you have to spin the fans faster to get more air to get the cooling down.
Wow. I was just thinking about that in terms of mental capacity, Greg, for some reason.
Yeah. Well, I actually thought to myself, why are they putting an altimeter in? Why not just monitor the temperature of the thing and blow air onto it until the temperature comes down? But,
That would kind of make sense. But see, on the other hand, they have Wi-Fi built in, and it's not available below 10,000 feet.
What?
What? Like your airplanes. And on the pause, that's not going to be a very good one. You can feel free to edit that.
Oh, no, it's staying in now.
Nice.
So that everyone in the audience can go, what?
Anybody who flies airplanes as much as I do, you understand that joke.
Right. So, Russ, I want you to define that complexity thing a little more.
On an airplane with an altimeter going 9,000, 9,500, 9,750. Wi-Fi!
Now you see the light go on, but yes.
Russ, I want you to define that complexity thing a little bit more, because someone sitting here, you know, who's a network engineer thinking, okay, I've been pondering this. I want to, you know, break up my network into OSPF domains, but I'm not sure where to put the boundaries. I mean, what do you, how do you guide them? And well, I know it depends and all that stuff.
Yes. How many balloons fit in a bag? But from my mind, the first thing I look at is I look at topology regions. I look at, you know, do I have a full mesh here and a hub and spoke there? Do I have two full meshes that are fairly dense networks, even if they're smallish, even if they're, you know, only 100 routers in a full mesh or, you know, something like that? Or do I have a large scale cloth or spine and leaf fabric that I'm using for a data center?
Okay, so just to try to, you know, put some, you know, real network stuff around, you know, the more general terminology. Let's say I've got a DMVPN domain that's out there, and it's dual hubs, and I've got a bunch of spoke routers that are dual homed into this DMVPN design. Maybe it makes sense to drop that into its own OSPF area, you know, and connect that into an area zero and keep it separate from your data center environment.
Right, and I think Greg's thoughts on the whole thing about security and DMZ zones being in their own area, I think, is a very, very valid point as well. So then you get to Scott's ideas, right? See, Scott works a lot with satellite links, so he's quite accustomed to these long delay, strange things. I could tell you this weird story about Scott calling me from a cruise ship. But anyway.
Hey, you know, it was important.
But at any rate, you know, again, you might want to think about splitting those things up into areas, because those links are more likely to fall into failure modes where they flap consistently, or there are problems with them where they brown out. And so they might have an adverse impact on the rest of your network just via the number of SPF calculations and the number of updates they're going to send.
Just an annoying amount of churn that's kicking in there. Anything from, you know, really negatively impacting things, depending on how difficult it is to keep up with the SPF calculations, to just simply being annoying because of routes coming up and going down all the time.
Well, and that's kind of the big part of it, is you look at whatever topology we're talking about and just kind of run a what-if scenario in your head. And, you know, if it's going to cause problems, then that's probably a good reason to separate something.
Right. And remember that, you know, EIGRP drops packets when there's a routing convergence event. OSPF and ISIS loop packets. They microloop during convergence events. So, you know, anytime you look at your topology and you say, well, you know, I've got this nice ring here that's kind of built between my data center core routers or my data center top up, or my data center edge routers and my core routers here, maybe I should think about breaking that ring up by putting the data center in a separate area or something like that, because I know what's going to happen when convergence happens on that large ring topology or whatever it is.
Now, is it enough to simply have separate areas, or do you also need to put in summarization rules at the ABR to achieve these goals we're talking about?
It depends on how many routes you're calculating for.
Yeah, and what you're using them for. If you're using them for security, like Greg is, then then you need aggregation, right?
Because you're trying to obfuscate specific route information.
Right, exactly.
It's not a secret that your network is 10.
Whatever, yeah.
Right. If you're publishing a 10.8 and saying, yeah, my network is 10.8, that's, you know, that's kind of the obvious. But if you're publishing the state database, and as Russ said, you can actually run an algorithm and calculate the whole architecture of the network, because every link state in the SPF database actually maps out the network.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's not a secret to leak I'm using 10. addressing. But it is a secret that it's architected in a certain way.
Yeah. How about some real world examples? Now, I mean, can we obfuscate, you know, vendors and, you know, customers, whatever networks we may have been working on, but can you talk about a scenario where splitting up a network into multiple areas solved a problem? You got any war stories you guys want to share?
You know, I mean, I guess you could pick just about any of them, but I mean, this is one from years ago, probably nine years ago now, was a kind of a national group, but who did updates to stores and did communications to various stores via satellite links. And originally, they had everything in one single area. And when you're dealing with satellite, not only is it not incredibly fast, but it also can be incredibly expensive. And so we're kind of wondering that, you know, the big problem was, you know, why is there all this data, you know, why is this all this stuff that we're paying for, and how much information are we really sending on here when we don't think we're going to be sending that much? And started to kind of look at it, and just judging by how much traffic was actually their routing protocol, sending updates back and forth and little things going up and down, and kind of got to laughing about it. And that was a prime use for areas.
And you're talking about expense in that, yes, it's a high latency, slow link, but also expensive in that you're paying per bit.
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So in this case, it behooves you to minimize the amount of routing protocol data going back and forth across this thing.
Yep.
So I once used OSPF areas we had an external cloud provider, and they wanted us to dynamically send the same network over two paths. Obviously, I was working in an institution which was very sensitive, and I had to create two separate OSPF areas to represent the two external data centers of the cloud provider, and they had the same IP addresses in both subnet, but not at the same time. So it was what was sort of like a cold standby. In other words, the data center would either be coming down this link or it would be coming down the other one, and it was a manual switchover. So we had two areas, a stub area off to the left and a stub area off to the right. And if the interface came up in the one on the right, then the one on the left had to be suppressed, just in case they were foolish, because who trusts a cloud provider, quite honestly?
<that's> Clearly not you.
Well, I trust them to run servers. I wouldn't trust them to run routers is basically where we were at. And the risk of them injecting this route down both sides and then traffic going black hole was actually quite high. And so we ended up with a whole bunch of conditional routing statements in the zone saying, you know, if I'm receiving this route from the far, you know, if I'm seeing the WAN subnet, then this route can be originated. But if I'm seeing the WAN subnet and I'm seeing the route on the other side, then I actually inject this route into the OSPF process. It was only possible to deliver that inside of an ITIL change environment because we created the stub areas. In other words, we weren't affecting the OSPF zone that ran the entire institution. It was a very large institution, you know, tens of thousands of staff. And any sort of, you know, OSPF route filtering in Area Zero is doomed to create faults, no matter. He's just taking an awful risk. So we were able to create these stub areas and use that, and we were able to fiddle around with the route filtering and the route injection, dynamic route injection, until we got it stable and reliable without affecting the entire OSPF process.
Well, that's really cool, Greg. That's an interesting use case. I think you beat Scott.
It sounds really cool, but you also got to remember that it took nearly 12 weeks to make that change. To do that.
I'll throw in a tangential story that is related to areas, and it touches on a topic that we haven't mentioned before when dealing with OSPF areas, which is the rule of intra versus inter area routing. And that is, if a route can be delivered intra area, it's going to take that route, that it's going to follow that path, even if going inter area, like into Area Zero and then back out again, might be a faster path. And I had this scenario once where a main line or a certain line would fail, an ISDN link would come up, and a whole bunch of routes would converge on that very slow ISDN link, even though they had a better path. And it's because of the link, or it's because of the area that ISDN link was in. The intra-area rule kicked in, and all of a sudden we had really slow network all of a sudden, just because this one backup link had come up to solve one little problem. Everything converged on that link because of what area that ISDN link was in, which makes the point that you need to be careful what interfaces you're putting into what areas, and thinking about during convergence events what's actually going to happen. How is traffic going to flow if a certain link goes down?
You know, Ethan, I actually had to, in some cases, use redistribution between OSPF processes to get around that sort of a problem because of the same rule in internals and externals.
So redistribution between OSPF areas, meaning they are external to each other and they look like type fives as you
yes.
redistribute into each other, right?
Yep. Because you have some backdoor connection between the areas for a backup link, and you know, those show up as externals or internals or whatever, and you end up with this situation where you end up routing all your traffic through a backdoor link that should only be used for some very specific purposes.
Yeah.
And You know, yeah,
of all the rules that we can't change, so we can change cost and a bunch of other stuff in OSPF, you can't change the preference of intra-area, then inter-area, then externals. It'll always be that way no matter what the cost turns out to be.
Yeah. So we've gone through a bunch of different area design scenarios, when you'd use them, why you'd use them. Another thing that hasn't come up yet, we were just talking about the intra and inter-area thing, but another thing that hasn't come up yet is running OSPF on a firewall, like say a Cisco ASA or something like that. Would you do it? Wouldn't you do it? And why or why not?
So I'm going to come up with a bit of horror stories, which I'm not going to bore you with the exact details because I'll just end up as a little fetal ball on the floor here with a gibbery drooling bit thing. But that, as someone who spent the better part of 5 to 7 years implementing OSPF on checkpoints or IBM firewalls or any sort of esoteric thing, the rule is never implement OSPF on a firewall. It is a curse on your life, right? It will blight your personal relationships. It will waste your nights and weekends on miserable rooting because the people who make firewalls make such lousy software, you're guaranteed that your OSPF is going to come out like a stinky turd, right?
But Greg, you've just made the case for a totally stubby area carrying with nothing but the firewall in it.
You're assuming that a firewall engineer knows what a totally stubby area is.
Now, I got to say, Greg, I've even had this issue on ASAs. The one device I have in my network that's running OSPF that I have had chronic problems with is a Cisco ASA running, I think it's 8.3 family code somewhere, where that's the one thing where I know I'm reliably not going to be able to get him to form an adjacency with two core switches. And all I need that firewall to do is just inject some VPN routes in. That's all I need it to do. And so predictably, the thing will get stuck in a state, and it's a pain in the rear end.
If you look at what you're trying to do with OSPF on a firewall, does it even make sense? I mean, aren't you trying to verify that traffic can pass through the firewall? But yet the OSPF process doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the forwarding process on that box. So
it's usually about egress paths.
Exactly. Right. That's my only scenario for it.
You want to say this is the way out of the network, and your firewalls might be distributed amongst multiple locations. Right. It's not normally things like internet gateways. It's when you've got in larger corporate networks, you often have 5 or 6 ways out of the network. So there's the internet's over here, the WAN's over here, and then you have a whole bunch of B2B segments where there's all these weird connections going on. Some of them are actually internet, some of them aren't, whatever. And you're trying to inject these routes into the network. But the best suggestion I have is your firewall vendor should use BGP. It's almost impossible for a firewall vendor to muck up BGP, right?
Or you can run BGP through the firewall.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, tunnel it through, even over EGI, worst case, do it over a GRE tunnel, or just, let the protocol through natively, although you've got some problems there because of CRC checks and stuff. But do BGP. You can get much finer policy controlled on BGP and say, do this with this and then that, and if this, then that, than you can on OSPF. So word from the bitterly, cynically, horrendously personal life deficient engineer, never do OSPF on a firewall, just move right along.
But have you guys had a positive experience with OSPF on a firewall to try to weigh things out more evenly?
No.
The day you remove it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so the day that you take it out or replace it with something else, that's the positive experience.
So all four of us are in agreement then. OSPF on firewall sucks and don't do it. Great.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, remember, a firewall is a router that doesn't work.
That's true. I can't disagree with that. That is true.
Nothing to change my opinion on that in 7.5 years.
That is so funny. I've been sitting staring at a Juniper SRX that I've got BGP running on one side of it and OSPF on the other because he's filtering between two major domains in my network and going, I really just want to do BGP everywhere and make the OSPF side of this thing go away. Maybe I should do that. But it's one of those things where I'll have to think about it for a long time to be able to actually make the change.
No, just listen to your own show now, Ethan.
Yeah. just do it. Just something he says, just do it.
Oh, I'll get there. I will. And with that, I think we're coming to the end of another fabulous Packet Bushers podcast. And let's go around the table one more time. I know you guys are both socially active and blog and write and all the rest. So plug all the things that you wish to plug, starting with Mr. Scott Morris.
Oh, wow. All the things I want to plug. Well, easy thing. You can follow me on Twitter at Scott Morris, CCIE. You can find me around on various message boards like Cisco Learning Network and things like that. Certainly find me at Cisco Live if you're out there. Otherwise, track me down at CBT Nuggets.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on the show. Much appreciated, sir. And you, Russ?
Well, you can always find me on Packet Pushers whenever I get the time to write, which I try to do regularly, but who knows. You can find me at Network Guru. You can find me on Twitter at Routing Geek. You can also find me in IPJ, Internet Protocol Journal. And I'm usually at NANOG and other places like that in the IETF, which I heard a rumor that Ethan might be coming to the next IETF.
Well, it might be. It's just a rumor because there's another much stronger rumor that he's trying to keep his travel to a minimum in 2015, and so he's being very selective about which planes he's going to put his butt in and suffer for hours and so
on. The ones with Wi-Fi.
That's right.
And what about you? Give you some recommendations on an altimeter to take with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about you, Greg? Parting thoughts and things to plug?
This week, it's mainly about the Priority Queue. We've got a bunch of shows coming up in the Priority Queue channel. So I plug the Network Break channel, but there's also the Priority Queue channel. So if you're only subscribed to the weekly show, don't hesitate to go over to our second channel there or subscribe to the full feed. I wouldn't recommend subscribing to the full feed because there's an awful lot of content in there. But do make a note of checking. And we do have other channels available on Packet Pushers.
Very good. And if you are interested in contributing to the content that Packet Pushers has to offer, one thing you might like to do is blog, like Russ does, at the community blog. We can set you up with an account for free, and you can share your experiences. And we've got people from all over the world that are doing exactly that. And you're thinking, I'm not smart enough. I don't know anything. I don't want to share. I can promise you, if you've done something interesting, solved some problem, done some solution to some issue you're facing at work, you got some project that you learned some things, blog about it. Other people would love to benefit from your experience. Just send us an email, packetpushers@gmail.com. Let us know that you're interested in blogging. And
everybody's got one blog post in them.
At least, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And Ethan, if anybody thinks they're not smart enough to blog, well...
the four of us blog, so...
Somebody made a great point about that. Recently. They said, that one of these guys had been working for a company and he'd been, a faithful salary slave for the better part of 15 years. And at the end of his time, he came out with a job title like network engineer. And he was actually running a massive network doing massive things. And when it came to interview time, people had to judge him only on his resume. And then he was talking to a friend of his who was a well-known, somebody who had a blog and had written extensively, and they were perceived as much more successful and much more whatever. So if you start blogging, you're going to be seen as much more intelligent and a better employability. Think of it as that.
Yeah,
it really is.
That's true. I mean, it's much more of a someone that can get the job done and is an authority on things. And again, as Greg said, everyone's got at least one blog post. And if you've only got one and you never write again, that's fine. We've had several Packet Pushers, people that have done exactly that. They blogged once, and I don't think they've blogged again, but they made a great contribution. And some people that blog one time have an article that are read thousands upon thousands of times. It's been a benefit to other people. I'm going to be posting stats at the end of 2014 for some of our popular blog articles, and it's amazing some of the things that people have written that just are a big benefit to people around the world because it helps them solve a problem. So enough about that. You can also follow Packet Pushers at Packet Pushers on Twitter. And I mentioned it before, but you can write to us, packetpushers@gmail.com. I am Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter. You can follow me on my blog, ethancbanks.com. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.